Richard Fieldhouse with the NESGP's The Art of Locoming podcast, and we're back again with Judith Harvey over Skype. It's a good couple of months ago now that Judith wrote this article on Venom, should I say, and it's and a lovely summer has passed. So we've been both of us rereading the article, and so really here today to chat about Venom which the obviously the entire blog is with the notes of the podcast, but it's always great to hear Judith's take on it. So Judith, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you.
Have you had a good sting-free summer holidays?
Yes, indeed. Yes, in Scotland, no midges.
No midges.
No midges. Well, we tend to go to the windy bits, and that keeps them at bay.
Yeah, no, very good. I understand there's been a lot more wasps around over this summer with the heat. And certainly in surgery, I've actually seen quite a lot of patients who've come in with various, obviously stings, but also lots of flies as well. So there's a lot, certainly locally, there's been a lot more of that around. So you wrote this huge sweeping article on Venom. And I mean, the basic line is that there are some, you say, 250,000 species of venomous creatures on the planet. And this sort of the global context is that there's quite a few people die from them. There are cures from them. There's poverty associated with this. So where should we start with this article? What brought you to putting it together?
Well, it's interesting. My first degree was in zoology, and I was very interested in bioluminescence, animals that give off light, and animals that use electricity. Electric eels is a famous one. But thinking back on it, I don't remember anything much about venomous animals. And my thinking about it was triggered because there was an exhibition at the Natural History Museum in London about venom. Long closed now, which had pictures of pit vipers and tarantulas and one or two live things in glass cases, but was mostly about all aspects of venom, including the medical. And that led me to do a bit of research on it to find out. Hence the article, which is a sort of summary of what I found out.
And one of the things that struck me, almost one of the most, go straight in at one of the most interesting things about the article, I think towards the end, speaking about biofluorescence, you mentioned this death stalker scorpion and its chlorotoxin in glioma cells.
Yes, now that's very interesting. I went to a talk at the Royal Institution a couple of years ago. There was Henry Marsh, the now retired neurosurgeon, and a research scientist, I think it was. And one of the things they were talking about was this, that attracting luminescent molecules to specific chemicals that are known to attach to glioma cells. That was the obvious interest for Henry Marsh as a neuroscientist. That was the obvious interest for Henry Marsh as a former neurosurgeon, that you could outline the glioma and therefore cut much more accurately.
So I guess a patient somehow with a glioma ingesting or somehow having this put in their body, it would almost light up parts of their brain like a runway, I guess. And then the surgeon goes and removes that, the glowing part of the brain, literally.
Yes, that's roughly it.
Incredible. And that is something to do with obviously with venom and its medical applications, and there's a whole lot of other interesting applications. What other particular ones interest you from this?
Well, I was fascinated to discover that captopril came from the venom of pit vipers. Now, I have tried very hard to find out how they got there from pit vipers to caterpillar, and it's not actually very easy to find out. Angiotensin converting agents were discovered in 1956, and Captopril came on the market in the early 70s. And it was a fairly long, windy path to get there. It was understanding about enzymes, in bradykinin particularly, and then that was found in venom, and that led to the examination of venom, the extraction of chemicals, and to make them useful and safe for treating hypertension, and also to make them so that they could be taken orally. So the trail is not well described in any article that I've read so far. But fascinating. There's Captopril. Successes every day. Thousands of people are on them. Millions.
And do we know when historically scientists or any such people started actually using or looking into venoms and what we can do with them in terms of healthcare?
Well, I think the ancient Egyptians were interested in venoms and their effects. Again, I haven't studied it, but this is a huge, huge topic. But yes, and snakes are such a powerful symbol. They evoke such strong reactions, and their effects are so ghastly. And the way they are administered is so frightening that, not surprisingly, probably every single culture throughout history has been interested in venom and their effects and what one might do with them for good or ill.
And in terms of sort of historically, and there's snakes, but there's also scorpions, and you mentioned about the, how was it in Iraq that people would put them in a bottle and throw them?
Yes, I think so. I found that mentioned, and I tracked it down, and it seemed to be a reliable. I think it was Iraq. Yes. They threw pots of scorpions at their enemies.
Yeah, I mean, great idea. What a fantastic, the first chemical weapons, I guess.
Could be, yes. And you could also throw spitting cobras at your enemies, and they would spit at the people's eyes.
Oh.
Spitting cobras go for the eyes, and they are able to predict where the eyes will be by the time the venom gets there.
How did they work that out? They obviously didn't look at YouTube videos for that one, did they? There's so much with evolution to do with this. I mean, it always strikes me that anything within evolution and mechanism, anything to do with death, obviously, it greatly differentiates the sort of survival of the fittest, doesn't it? And so the most complex, sophisticated things to do with evolution, animals and the animal world is to do with that time, you know, what's going to kill you, what's going to make you live. And again, I think that's why a lot of this article is so much about death, but it's so much about saving lives as well. I mean, and I'm back on scorpions in terms of, I read, and you say in this article as well, that the scorpions are, deaths from scorpions are really on the rise, aren't they?
Yes. There are snakes more or less everywhere, not Ireland, but most places. And most places there will be a venomous snake, even if, like our adder, it's very rarely kills anybody, hasn't killed anybody in this country for 40 years. Scorpions are much more confined in their worldwide occurrence. We in this country, we in most of Europe, are not worried by scorpions, so they don't have that fear factor that they do in countries where they're everywhere in desert environments, particularly in the Middle East, for example.
And I read recently, at the beginning of the summer, that that particularly in Brazil, I think the actual mortality from scorpion stings has doubled in recent years, particularly in the favelas, the slums, and as the rainforest is eaten up and cities move into those areas, and you get the scorpions moving in. And in the article, you talk about a lot about poverty and the expense and the research, you know, the story of Captopril, how on earth science has evolved to extract these hundreds, thousands of different chemicals and factors and anticoagulants and vasodilators that go alongside these toxins, extract those, test them on horses, and then it's really difficult to store this stuff, yet actually in the concentrated places where we store all these and research these things and can afford to use them are actually not necessarily the places where you're actually likely to be stung by a venomous creature. And you mentioned there's some 100,000 deaths a year across the world from venom and some 400,000 amputations.
Yes, that's right. Because a lot of venom contain chemicals which break up tissues.
Yeah.
That's part of the way they act on the animal, to immobilize it, to kill it, to provide food for its predator. And yes, and it's not the anti-venoms are a very sophisticated medication and an expensive medication, and the transport requirements, including cold chains for many of them, are just beyond poor countries. And the problem is the people in these countries are at risk from all sorts of venoms. And one venom, anti-venom, is just good against that particular venom. It's not good against the next animal's venom. And even some animals, some snakes, I think, change their venom with their age as their prey, as they change the animal they predate on.
Wow.
So it's very complicated, very, very complicated.
So not only sophisticated but biochemical weapon, but also biomechanical as well. We're talking, you know, different methods of delivery and piercing armor and all sorts of things.
I gather that if you look through the animal kingdom, almost any part of the body has been developed by some animal for delivering venom. And venom has been evolved hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different times through evolution in different groups. And even within spitting cobras, there are several, it seems to have evolved, the spitting venom seems to have evolved several times in different groups.
Independently?
Yes. It's a matter of convergent evolution.
Reading your article, one of the most deadliest sounding of all the creatures, particularly its name, is a primate, the slow loris. Now, I thought I'd never heard of that, so I googled it, and it looks like it's a little panda monkey. And the first thing you want to do is cuddle one of these little gorgeous things. But then you say they've got a spiny fang or tooth or something in their elbow?
Yes, apparently. They didn't evolve that to harm humans. And very little, very few venomous systems have evolved, even against primates. But this is presumably to attract some other prey, which then I'm not sure whether it's a deterrent or whether it actually kills the person who approaches, or the animal that approaches. Yeah. So yes, it I think this is a new subject, partly because we are only just beginning to understand just how many venomous creatures there are in the world. And we knew about jellyfish and snakes and scorpions, but the fact that so many animals actually have venom is only fairly recently in research terms becoming apparent. And that's partly because a lot of these venoms don't do us any harm, because they're not made to harm us, they're made to harm something else.
Right. So we're sort of almost stumbling across, so we actually actively go out and look for their venom.
Yeah. Humans are collateral damage in this evolutionary arms race. We don't feel upset if a jellyfish kills some other sea creature, which is of no great interest to us either, because of its appearance or its food value or any other reason. We're not bothered by that. Mm. And so we don't look for it, we don't discover it. Now it's being looked for.
My children recently told me, I think they've been watching an American program, so I think it's an American insect, the daddy long legs, not the UK version, but apparently it's the most deadliest, or it's got the most deadliest venom of any creature, but apparently it's such that it is no way it could ever deliver a sting to a human, because it's just jaws could never do that. But again, someone somewhere must have decided to dissect a very common creature and actually come across this. I hope they didn't have any. Didn't hope they didn't die themselves from it. But yes, there's so much out there to explore. Gosh,
part of it is watching naturalists, zoologists, ecologists watching animals and watching their behaviour and realising they must be using venom, and therefore investigating further.
Right.
Getting hold of specimens, extracting venom and clarifying it chemically.
Yeah.
And also observing the effect of the venom on the victim, so you can get an idea of what it can achieve in the venom, what sort of chemicals you're looking for.
Towards the end of the article, you actually go into a whole load of new. There's some new drugs that the pharma industry has been looking at. And there's quite a few diabetic drugs for diabetes included in there as well. There's a very interesting one, a spider venom that causes priapism, and as you're saying, is going to be a possible treatment for erectile dysfunction. Just the list of potential conditions that stuff we wouldn't have thought would have anything related to venom. So there's a whole myriad of potential diseases that can have cures for them, all because of this.
Yes, and what a venom does on one animal, prey animal, may be quite different from what it does on a quite related species that it doesn't prey on. It's very complicated. So you can't assume, say, because a venom does this to another primate, it's going to do the same to us or a third primate. So it has to be terribly, the work of individualizing the what's in a venom and what potential it might have is absolutely endless.
I suppose it's almost like a research equivalent of investigating a crime scene, isn't it? You've got all these motives and different types of weapon that we don't know anything about, because they're all at a molecular level and working all this. That's a very different, must be a very different approach to pharma research and development than, I guess, stumbling across a culture dish where very, you know, petri dishes of fungus and penicillin, etc., and just observing simple chemical reactions. There's a real lot of investigation to go on here.
Yes, I think the comparison with a crime scene is very apt. That is what it's like, I imagine.
Yeah.
You have to observe and work out what might be going on, test your hypothesis. when you've got some sort of answer, then you have to think, how might some of that translate into benefits for humans?
Wonderful, Judith. Well, that's really good to hear. Again, from you on this, it's going to appreciate you wrote it a couple of months ago as well. So, but I think we've done really well to encapsulate what the article is about. But really worth a good read there. There's some links at the end as well. I've got put a link in on the blog to the Natural History Museum website as well. And so thank you once again, Judith. Really good to talk to you, and we'll no doubt catch up on the next podcast with your latest article that's in the forthcoming magazine as well, which listeners will have to look out for. So thank you very much, Judith.
Not at all. Thank you. It was nice to go over it again and refresh my memory.
Good. Thank you. Bye-bye.
So fun.